This is Company Cars, the podcast that tries to make sense of the car business. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Company Cars. This week, we're going to explore the rapidly disappearing affordable new car segment, and we're also bringing back Rental Car Roulette, featuring a recent rental car that I drove for a few hundred miles and became really familiar with over the course of a week. So what do I mean by an affordable new car? So the definition of what an affordable new car has changed over time, but the segment that I'm thinking of is the segment that is traditionally slotted below a normal compact car. So the segment that has always existed somewhat below what a brand new Toyota Corolla or Honda Civic would cost, although part of the rapid disappearance of affordable new cars has also been the result of attrition and withdrawal of automakers in the compact car segment as well. So if we flash back to about 10 years ago, these subcompact and compact new cars were all the rage in the business. I think there's some really good press footage and press coverage from the financial crisis where Ford and GM announced their increased commitment to making small cars and to making them in the United States. So we went through this renaissance in the early 2010s, where we saw the reemergence of a lot of compact cars like the Ford Fiesta, the Chevy Sonic, the Chevy Spark, the Honda Fit, and the Toyota Yaris. And what's fascinating is since about 2015, these subcompact cars have fallen off the face of the earth and dropped like flies. And so in this episode, we're going to explore partly why that is and some of the factors that have influenced that rapid disappearance of this affordable new car segment. And so this topic is especially top of mind to many in the automotive business right now because there's been substantial press coverage over two issues. One is the rapid escalation in the average price of a new vehicle. And so in some of the early episodes of this podcast, I may have mentioned that the average new vehicle price was somewhere around $38,000, $39,000, $40,000. Well, for 2021, there's emerging data that suggests the average new vehicle price has jumped from that number to around $45,000 or $46,000, which is quite expensive when you compare it with average annual household income in the United States. And the other reason this topic is particularly interesting right now is there's also been substantial press coverage about one specific affordable new car that has seen an almost insatiable amount of demand, and that's the Ford Maverick compact pickup truck. And so Ford recently took the unprecedented step that they were going to close the ability for consumers and dealers to place any additional orders for a few months. So in essence, saying the Maverick was completely sold out, and they're just trying to catch up and work through their current overwhelming order backlog. And the Maverick is this amazing car that's extremely practical and affordable, and it's almost a great case study in showing that there is demand for an affordable new car, but for whatever reason, automakers are choosing not to offer products in this segment. And so we'll explore why this is the case, why this trend hasn't received more attention, how this affects us consumers, and maybe what the Maverick's example and how the Ford Maverick has been received by the market, what that can tell us about future growth trends in the car business. So in recent years, automakers have announced with increasing frequency their decision to discontinue many of the more affordable cars in their lineup. So in recent years, Ford has discontinued the Fiesta and the Focus. GM has discontinued the Chevy Spark, the Chevy Sonic, and the Chevy Cruze. Toyota has discontinued the Yaris and its entire Scion brand of affordable new cars. And Honda has discontinued the Fit subcompact hatchback. And all these automakers have stopped making these smaller cars, but I think it's important to take a minute and think about how did we end up with all of these small cars in the first place? So coming out of the financial crisis, fuel prices were high, consumers were not feeling particularly willing to spend a lot of money, and they wanted to cut down on their fuel costs. So there was a lot of interest in these compact, fuel-efficient vehicles, which tend to be pretty affordable. So these are also cars that oftentimes people will buy as their first brand new car, or people who have tight budget constraints and need a new car will oftentimes buy some of these smaller, more affordable vehicles. And so with fuel prices being at an all-time high after the financial crisis, there was a lot of demand for these products. And so there was also a lot of political interest and pushing the automakers to make these products because the financial crisis era rescue packages for General Motors and Chrysler suddenly gave the federal government and policymakers an additional lever to potentially encourage these automakers to produce smaller, more fuel-efficient vehicles. So, for example, in the government rescue package for Chrysler that involved selling the company to Fiat, there actually was a provision in the agreement between the United Auto Workers, Fiat, and the U.S. government that Fiat Chrysler would eventually produce a compact sedan that met a minimum miles per gallon target. And so Fiat Chrysler did fulfill their end of the bargain. They produced the Dodge Dart, which was sold for a few years before it was discontinued. So there was a lot of interest in having these small cars, so the automakers went to work producing them. And one issue here is that there are very high fixed costs in engineering and designing a new car. And so even though it's still slightly less expensive to engineer a small car because you can use older technology, you don't have to use cutting-edge materials, it's not 50% less expensive to engineer a $20,000 car versus a $40,000 car. So these fixed costs of a vehicle program, like the cost of engineering the Ford Fiesta, for example, become a much larger share of the vehicle's overall manufacturing costs, which means the automaker now needs to drive really high sales volume to turn a profit on that particular portfolio. Because if your engineering costs are the same, whether you manufacture and sell 100,000 units of the Fiesta or 250,000 units of the Fiesta, then your cost per unit goes down, right? And so making money on small cars requires largely following the Walmart model. You need to drive a lot of volume and sell a lot of cars. And so the issue here is, if you need really high volume to turn a reasonable profit on something like a Ford Fiesta, this becomes extremely risky in the United States. And this becomes really risky as all of your competitors are also piling into this market to try and address this market need for compact cars. So what happens is automakers brought these cars out. Not all of them were very successful, or maybe some were successful for a few years and then became less popular as the designs aged. And so GM, Ford, and Toyota and Honda, they may have had some initial success with these products, but in the U.S. market, what's really interesting is also there's a very robust used car market, and car buyers will oftentimes prefer to trade up one size category and instead buy a 1 to 2 year old used car versus a brand new one. So these cars came out, and while they did really well initially and there was a lot of interest, over time, as the novelty of these smaller compact cars kind of wore off, then American consumers started reverting to their old buying patterns. And so it also didn't help that as the 2010s moved on and as we got past 2015, we also saw the decline in fuel prices, partly due to advances in oil drilling and oil technology, which made the incremental fuel efficiency benefits from these ultra-small cars not as compelling to American consumers as having maybe a slightly larger car, like a Toyota Corolla or sometimes even a Honda Accord, from these same automakers. And so now what the automakers are realizing is that, well, wait a minute, like, we can't continue to update this car because the ROI is not there. We have much better uses for our engineers' time than having them update and refresh the Ford Fiesta or the Chevy Sonic. So let's take that engineering talent and allocate it to more profitable growth areas like compact SUVs or midsize SUVs. But then you start this vicious cycle a bit where the product gets a little stale. Consumers who might have been interested in these cars now suddenly find themselves not that interested because as these cars sit and age, they're using technology from earlier in the 2010s, but automakers are redesigning the next category up, these compact sedans, for example. So by the end of the 2010s, compact sedans like Corollas and Civics got similar fuel efficiency numbers than their smaller cousins like the Fit or the Yaris. But these cars were bigger, these cars had more features, these cars were not much more money, especially on a per month basis, which we'll get to in a minute. And so these cars from one category up suddenly became really attractive, and automakers began to cannibalize their own sales in these ultra small product segments. And so consumer demand for these products basically came and went pretty quickly. And so because that there are huge volumes involved, there's not many automakers who can generate enough volume in this subcompact space. And even in the compact sedan space, so one category up, that's much larger and has a lot more consumer interest in it. So this is the category of cars like your Corollas, your Civics, your Nissan Sentras. Even in that category, you need so high volumes to make your engineer, to offset your engineering costs, that there's really not a ton of room for a smaller niche player who maybe will sell 40 or 50 or 60,000 compact sedans a year. You really have to sell a large number of cars. And so what happened is automakers who were less strong in these categories just started to quit the business altogether or view it primarily as a side business. And so they don't invest a lot of time and effort, but maybe they still offer a product because they need to meet the needs of fleet customers. So for example, Hyundai in recent years, they sell this Accent, which is a subcompact car that was really popular in the early 2010s. But in recent years, as consumers have substituted up to the Elantra and to other products in Hyundai's portfolio, Hyundai still sells an Accent, but they spend no advertising money on it. They don't really stock dealer lots with them. It's mainly there to be there and to offer a product primarily to fleet customers to say, hey, if you need a subcompact car, say for your rental car fleet, we can sell you an Accent, but we're not really going to make the Hyundai Accent for retail use. It's just kind of there. And for retail customers, Hyundai would rather you consider a Hyundai Venue, which is a subcompact SUV, but costs several thousand dollars more and is much more profitable. So this business at the low end or at the affordable end of the new car segment is actually extremely challenging because of the low prices you need to hit and the high fixed cost tied to engineering a new product. And so what's happened is we've had the weaker players fall off, leaving the stronger players like Honda, Toyota, and Nissan and Hyundai, Kia to really hone in and focus on meeting the needs of the customers who are left. And so the downside of this is there's a lot less consumer choice in this segment than there was in 2013 or 2014 or 2015. Okay, so we have this business where you need huge volume to make any money in. And so what's happened is we now are consolidating this business around a couple automakers who largely dominate the business. So GM, Ford, and Chrysler are largely not in the business of selling subcompact or even compact or midsize family sedans. And so this has left us with Honda, Toyota, Nissan, Hyundai, and Volkswagen primarily being the automakers that are serving the market needs in this business. But what's been interesting is, yes, so people are dropping out of this business, but sometimes it pays to have a product that is the entry point to your portfolio because it helps you to build a relationship with a customer. And so when that customer finally needs something larger, it may be easier to keep them in the brand versus watching them go elsewhere. And that's oftentimes the argument that's put forth by the automakers who are still in this business, that these products are worth it because it's not just about meeting the customer's needs today. It's about building a relationship with them in the future, or maybe down the line because you sold them a Corolla today, if you're Toyota. They like their Corolla, and when they need a bigger car or have more money, maybe they'll buy a Toyota Highlander or a Lexus product from you. So that's one of the arguments for why some automakers are still in this business. But what's really interesting is GM, Ford, and Chrysler know that this is a big gap in their product portfolio. And so while for the most part in the past couple years, they haven't really cared about leaving the space open because it's not very profitable on its own, and they feel comfortable that they'll be able to bring in customers when they do buy those more expensive SUVs and trucks. But what Ford has chosen to do recently, and this is the Ford Maverick that I'm talking about, is they decided to try and experiment with re-entering this affordable car space. So they recognize some of the points that some automakers put out where being in this affordable car space is very helpful because it helps you bring younger buyers into the brand. And they had already completely dropped the small affordable car business. So they had dropped the Fiesta and the Focus in 2018. And they even got out of the midsize sedan business, so slightly more expensive, by dropping the Fusion after 2020. So at this point, the least expensive car that Ford sells has a base price above $20,000, and it's the Ford EcoSport, which hasn't sold very well either. So Ford, in looking at their engineering tools and their plant capacity and what they could do, decided to come up with something that was really unique. And so they looked at the same engineering work that they had used for the Ford Escape and the Ford Bronco Sport, two very popular compact SUVs, and they realized they could use that same underlying architecture to build a compact pickup truck, which they decided to call the Maverick. And so because the Maverick was a bolt-on project, not the original project designed with that engineering work for the Escape and the Bronco Sport, this work had already been done, so the incremental cost to put the Maverick together was very low because they had already done a large chunk of the work on Escape and Bronco Sport. But what's really interesting is they decided to try and reach down into a more affordable price segment with the Maverick than the Escape and the Bronco Sport, both of which start above $25,000. And they decided to sell a version of the Maverick for $19,995, which is incredibly affordable for a new car. Like, that is a lower starting price than a Toyota Corolla. And certainly Ford is forcing the customer who buys a $19,995 Ford Maverick to make a lot of compromises, but they were really smart about it. So they put a hybrid engine into the entry-level Maverick, and it's the same hybrid engine from the Ford Escape Hybrid. So there are greater economies of scale that help to bring down the cost of the Ford Escape Hybrid's powertrain as well. And they were very smart about deleting features from the Maverick. So at the $19,995 level, you don't have some basic niceties that consumers have come to expect, like cruise control or adaptive cruise control or even blind spot warning. That's an optional package. So they offered this really low price, almost like a teaser price, but it drew a lot of attention to the Maverick. And even though most Mavericks sell between $25,000 and $30,000, the Maverick became an instant hit among consumers because consumers viewed this little pickup truck as being extremely functional, maybe more functional than a comparable Corolla or Civic or Sentra, and extremely low frills and a lot of car for the money. So maybe some people don't want all of the super advanced features that we see in a lot of modern new cars. Like, the Maverick has the basics. So the Maverick has forward collision warning, has air conditioning, power windows, but it doesn't have power mirrors. So they took out the power mirrors to make it affordable. But it has some of the basic features that people are looking for, and it has Apple CarPlay and Android Auto. And so Ford realized that there's maybe a market of people who don't want a car that's like fully equipped. Maybe this will be a second car for somebody, or maybe this will be a car for a teenager or somebody buying their first car. So the Maverick was a hit. And I think it was a much bigger hit than Ford had anticipated, because they had allocated some amount of factory space to assemble the Maverick, and demand just overwhelmed the dealers for these cars. So Ford needed to cut off the order bank for the Maverick earlier this year. And so I'm sure they didn't want to do that. I'm sure they probably do make just a little bit of money on the Maverick because the incremental cost of doing the work for it was so low. But this car has proven to be much more popular than people want. And that's partly because there's not a lot of choices in new cars under $25,000. Like, I think I've probably mentioned them all. It's Corolla, Civic, Sentra, the Volkswagen Jetta, the Hyundai Elantra, and the Kia Forte. And so you might be able to get some entry-level subcompact SUVs under $25,000. So something like a Chevy Trailblazer, or a Chevy Trax, or a Hyundai Venue, or a Toyota Corolla Cross, or a Honda HR-V. But those will be the base models as well in that subcompact SUV category. So there's not a lot of choices. So this has created this gap in the marketplace for this affordable new car, which oftentimes consumers might prefer over a used car to some because there's less risk associated with buying a new car in terms of buying a car that may have mechanical issues. New cars are also cheaper to finance, and they're pretty homogenous, so you can buy them from a large number of dealers, and you don't have to look at each individual car like a snowflake. And so that has made the Maverick really attractive and driven a lot of popularity for the car. So it'll be interesting to see where Ford takes this, but that's part of the reason for the Maverick's success, is that there just hasn't been that much choice sub $30,000. And its success proves that there's a lot of demand for kind of this affordable new car segment that to date, other automakers and have not really figured out how to design a compelling product that would cost low enough to design, but be appealing and attractive to entry-level car shoppers. And now it's time for a short break. We'll hear from our sponsors and we'll share some information about how to submit a listener question. The Company Cars podcast is sponsored by Rejected Conjectures Incorporated, a division of Integrated Derivatives. If you have a question that you want answered on the show, write us an email at companycarspodcast@gmail.com. This subtle shift in the product mix of automakers over the past 3 to 5 years has largely gone on unnoticed, except for a few press articles saying that Ford is discontinuing the Fiesta and the Focus, or GM is no longer selling sedans. There hasn't been a lot of press coverage devoted to the increasing average new vehicle price over time and the loss of affordable new car options at the entry level of the market. And this hasn't really caused a lot of severe issues for borrowers because in automotive lending, there have been several innovations. And so lenders after the financial crisis realized that borrowers were more likely to make their car payment before their housing payment in many cases because borrowers rationalized that in theory, you could live in your car, but you couldn't drive your house to work. And so lenders realized that borrowers were more likely to pay back their car loans, all else equal, than maybe they had previously thought in the 2000s, where the conventional wisdom was you need a place to live, so you make your housing payment first, then you make your car payment. And so that order flipped a little bit after the financial crisis. And so lenders have been willing to take on much more risk tied to car loans. The other nice thing about car loans as a lender is if you need to repossess the car, it's pretty easy to repossess and resell a car, especially in current used car markets. Whereas repossessing and reselling a house, as we learned during the financial crisis, takes a lot more work and takes a lot longer time. So lenders have gotten really aggressive in terms of what they're willing to lend against and how much car you can purchase given a particular income level. And so oftentimes you'll see lenders be willing to accept no money down or even negative amounts down. Longer loan terms, we've seen the average new vehicle loan go from 60 months to 72 months, and now it's like somewhere between 72 and 84 months, and we're seeing increasing frequency of 96 and 108 month loans compared with 5 years ago, and also the credit scores that you need to qualify for a car loan have come down dramatically. And so this has expanded car shoppers' ability to be approved for larger loan amounts than before and to buy newer and nicer cars than they had been buying previously. And so this has masked some of the issues tied to new vehicle affordability that would be a consequence of a dearth of affordable options. So the change in monthly payment versus before is not quite as severe as it looks because lenders can mask it with longer loan terms and different payment structures. So there has been this financial innovation that's accompanied it. I mean, certainly the downside here is now if people have these very long 72, 84, 96 month car loans, then it maybe hurts their ability to buy new cars. And so that's something that I think has been untested so far in the marketplace. And so we'll see how it goes over the next few years, because people don't tend to hold on to their cars for 84 or 96 months. I think on average, people tend to trade cars around somewhere in the 5 to 7 year window if they're purchasing. And so we'll set aside leases for a minute here. And so this means that oftentimes borrowers will still have a little bit left on their car loan when they trade in their car. And for a dealership, that's not a problem. It's just a lot of paperwork, but it could be a problem if you owe more on the car than what it's worth when you go to trade it in. And so we'll dig more into automotive lending in a different episode. But just know that automotive lending innovations have allowed consumers to buy more car for the same income, and that has masked some of the issues tied with not having that many affordable new car options. And so what does this lack of affordable new car options mean for consumers? And For us, unfortunately, it means that if you're looking for a brand new car and you don't want to spend more than $25,000, the selection out there is not as good as it once was, and so you're largely limited to entry-level or moderately equipped compact sedans from the Japanese and Korean automakers, and entry-level subcompact SUVs. And so hopefully there's something in that pool of vehicles that you like. There's a lot of really, really good cars. I mean, just because a car is affordable doesn't mean it's not a well-built, reliable, comfortable car with a lot of features. So I'm thinking of things like the Honda Civic, Toyota Corolla, Mazda 3, Honda HR-V, and Toyota Corolla Cross, among others, are all really wonderful new cars that you can purchase for under $25,000 or around $25,000 if you want a few more features. And while a lot of people might suggest considering a used car, the used car market right now is also pretty difficult to navigate. And if you need to finance the car, financing a used car might be more expensive in terms of interest rates and payment terms. So you may be better off with a new car for a lot of people. And so I think that's one reason why I think this affordable new car segment is so important, because for many buyers in this segment, kind of shopping under $25,000, the big thing that a new car can provide you is stability, because it's unlikely that you'll need to make any expensive repairs in the first 3 or 4 years. And if you do, there's a manufacturer-backed warranty for that. And so really, your transportation expenses are much more predictable because they become your monthly car payment plus the cost of fuel plus insurance. And so there's a lot less that's unexpected. And that predictability is oftentimes really, really valuable if you're operating with very strict parameters or you don't feel comfortable spending a lot of money on your car. And so, I mean, you could also stretch your budget a little bit and shop closer to $30,000, but with a longer loan term, say an 84 or 96 month loan. But one downside with doing that is that's a really long-term loan. And so you need to be really worried about whether or not you will have positive equity in the car. So will you owe less on the car than what it's worth later? Because if you owe more money on the car than what it's worth, so you have negative equity or you're upside down, as many people would say, then in the event that something happens and you get into an accident or the car becomes mechanically totaled and your insurance company has to pay out, then if you're upside down on your loan, you have to bring cash to the deal to get rid of your car. And that's not great. If let's say you got in a car accident, you're already dealing with all sorts of issues related to the accident, and now you have to write a big check to walk away from a car that you don't own anymore. And so if you do decide to stretch your budget and shop closer to $30,000 with a longer loan term, like 84 or 96 months, I would seriously consider getting gap insurance. Which gap insurance, what it does is, if you owe more money on the car than what it's worth, and let's say you total it, gap insurance will write a check to cover the difference. And so that way you can just walk away from the car without worrying about the upside down loan balance. And you can buy this when you go to buy the brand new car, when you do the finance and insurance visit. I'm sure that the finance and insurance manager would be more than happy to sell you gap insurance, but you can also purchase gap insurance from your car insurance company. So there are many car insurance companies that sell gap coverage. And so it's a very minuscule risk, but if you do have an 84 or a 96 month loan, the probability that you'll owe more on the car than what it's worth for a good chunk of the car loan is quite high. And so in that case, then gap insurance might be useful. If you're financing for a shorter loan term, so anything 60 months or less, it might not be as useful to have gap insurance. I mean, certainly if you're putting zero money down, gap insurance is probably helpful, but let's say you have a very short 36-month loan. Even if you put zero down, you're probably going to have positive equity in the car within about 5 or 6 months. So the risk is pretty low. And if you're financing for 36 months, you probably have some of the financial cushion to absorb some of the losses in the event you have an accident that writes off the car while you have negative equity. So just some things to think about if you're working with a really constrained budget here. And so lots of people shopping in this price point that previously would have bought a new car are now much more likely to buy a used car. And so that's also an option too. There's a lot of really wonderful used cars. cars are lasting a lot longer than they used to, so buying a three-year-old car isn't quite as used of a used car as it was, say, in the late 1990s or early 2000s. And so just a couple different options, but I think this end or this reduction in choices of affordable new cars is definitely something to think about and something to watch as a consumer. And just to wrap it up before we get into rental car roulette, I did want to take a minute and talk about whether this trend will persist, whether we'll continue to have very few choices in the affordable car segment, or whether there might be a chance that this would reverse. And unfortunately, I think this is probably going to persist, especially as the business shifts to being an electric-focused business. At this point in time, the batteries for electric cars are still pretty expensive, so it's pretty difficult to have an electric vehicle under $30,000 even. And I think the closest we've come is the Chevrolet Bolt. But my understanding is when General Motors sells the Chevrolet Bolt under $30,000, it doesn't make a lot of money or any money at all. So that's definitely a concern. And Elon Musk and Tesla has talked about producing a $25,000 Tesla, but because Tesla has had kind of a tough time meeting the timelines, that might be something to take with a grain of salt and to have a little more confidence in that position when we see some more concrete evidence that the car is coming. So I think in the near term, at least over the next couple of years, there's definitely going to be this shortage of affordable cars, especially as inflation takes hold and it becomes more expensive even just to manufacture the car. So we may have this thing where our perception of what an affordable car is will shift over time, because affordability is somewhat relative. And if you're a shopper, that's just something to keep in mind, that there may be fewer choices out there in the affordable car segment. But that's not always a bad thing, especially when it's the strongest choices that survive. So compact sedans, for example, that's kind of the newest affordable segment that's out there, since the subcompact segment is largely gone or has gotten more expensive. And like, there's a lot of excellent compact cars like Civics, Corollas, Sentras, Elantras. And if you think about it, we've come full circle in a way, because 25 or 30 years ago, these cars were the subcompact cars and they were the entry level products into many automakers' portfolios. It's just that over the years, these cars have grown, they've gotten larger, they've gotten bigger, they've gotten heavier, they've gotten more loaded with technology, that they're created room for automakers to slot a product underneath these cars. And I think we're just coming back full circle, and just that our expectations for what an affordable car needs to have changed over time. And I think that's not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, certainly if you go and look at a Civic or a Corolla today, it probably has as much interior room and as much trunk space and as much functionality as a Honda Accord or Toyota a Camry did in the early 1990s. So as technology moves, kind of our bar for what an affordable car is will also need to move, but we are getting much better affordable cars than we did 30 years ago. And so it's a little bit of a give and take. And so I think it'll be interesting to see how the transition to electric goes in terms of, can we have an affordable electric car like a Chevy Bolt or a Nissan Leaf? Or will electric cars further accelerate the trend of new cars becoming expensive, extremely expensive relative to household incomes? And I think that the jury is still out on that. And now it's time for Rental Car Roulette. All right, we are bringing back Rental Car Roulette after a brief hiatus. And I have some exciting news here, because I've had to travel a bit for the past couple weeks, and that's partly why there was a delay in the podcast episodes. But the upside is I've had to rent a few cars. So we're going to have some great content here for Rental Car Roulette. And the first run at the wheel was I needed to rent a car, and I needed it for the whole week. I was kind of traveling between a few different places, and I rented a car from Budget, whom I normally don't rent from very frequently. But I was really curious what I would be assigned, because they don't let you choose any car from the aisle. They hand you a car, so this is truly random in terms of what I would be assigned, because at Hertz, you know, you walk down the aisle and your own biases can sometimes creep in to what you want to pick and what seems interesting. But this time it was totally random, which is pretty exciting. And the rental car agent handed me the keys to a 2021 Jeep Compass Trailhawk. And so, as soon as I saw the keys when she handed them to me, I was a little bummed to be driving a Jeep Compass because I have pretty negative priors on the Compass. And the Compass oftentimes gets a lot of bad criticisms for being just not a very good car, either, especially the first generation Compass, which was sold from, I think, around 2007 to around 2016. And so now we're in the second generation Compass that I think was unveiled around 2016, 2017, and is still on the market today and was recently refreshed for 2022. So I'm driving I drove a pre-refresh version, and normally I'd be more disappointed, but a couple things made this particular Compass interesting. So this one was interesting because it was a super high-end Trailhawk model. So it had a very sophisticated four-wheel drive system. It had heated and cooled leather seats, had a panoramic sunroof, and it had a heated steering wheel. And especially in 2021, and for somebody who rents regularly from Hertz, who likes to keep cars a very long time, one really big advantage of this Compass was it had relatively low miles for a rental car in 2021. So it had about 15,000 miles, which during the pre-COVID times might have been on the higher end or like somewhere in like the middle 50 percentile. But in COVID times, this was great. This was super low mileage. And so I was very excited about this car. And it was also bright orange, so a very distinctive color. And the Trailhawk also has some really nice, fun accessory pieces. So the tow hooks are painted bright red. So definitely a car that really stood out. And so I was pretty curious about if maybe my opinion on the Compass would change after spending some time with it. And the car was fine. So it handled like a crossover. It wasn't especially fun to drive. It wasn't especially fast. It was reasonably quiet, except under hard acceleration. And I did have a pretty difficult time getting comfortable in the driver's seat. But I think some of that is because this is a car that seemed like it was designed for taller people. And I'm not a very tall person, and so I'm maybe just not the right person for the car. But I did have two major complaints with the car. So one is, this car is expensive. So this car, I looked up the window sticker for this car afterwards, and this car had an MSRP of $38,000, and it did not have a power tailgate. And you could actually buy an SUV one size category higher, so you could get like a compact SUV, like a CR-V or a RAV4, and get most of the features in this Compass Trailhawk in that SUV one category higher. So actually, for $38,000, you could get a Subaru Forester Touring, which had everything that this Compass had except for the ventilated seats. And so at MSRP, this car was not very good value for money, if I'm being honest. I mean, I'm pretty sure Avis Budget Group did not pay MSRP. I'm pretty sure they paid a little bit less because when I returned the car, they just had a lot of Compasses and they had a lot of Compass Trailhawks too. So I'm pretty sure they didn't pay MSRP for this car. The other big issue I had was this car had a very, very small fuel tank. So I could only drive about 260, 270 miles before I had to buy fuel. And this really puts a whole new spin on range anxiety. So we typically think of range anxiety as being primarily about EVs, but I had pretty severe range anxiety on this car. I was driving in some pretty rural places where I wasn't sure I'd be able to buy gas. And I had the time when I was going to buy gas to make sure that I wouldn't be stuck on the side of the road somewhere on my drive. So there were some good things about this car. I mean, I think this car's four-wheel drive, all-wheel drive system is quite sophisticated, especially for the money. It had a true low-range gear for some light off-roading. I liked the panoramic sunroof, and I really liked Fiat Chrysler's infotainment system. So the Uconnect infotainment system was incredibly easy to use, which is really valuable in a rental car because you don't live with this car every day and you're usually under time constraints. So you don't have 3 to 5 hours to learn all the intricacies of a car's infotainment. You just have to get in and go. And so what was nice about this car is all of the infotainment was very intuitive and very easy to use. And so I have to give Chrysler a lot of credit for that. But I think for the money, I would honestly spend my money elsewhere. If I had $38,000, I would probably get a compact SUV one size higher and maybe not get something so off-road focused. So I might get a Mazda CX-5 or a Toyota RAV4 Hybrid or a Subaru Forester, because $38,000 is just a lot of money for a subcompact SUV. And these issues and these concerns I had with the Compass are going to come into more focus when I talk about the next rental car that I had, which I'll do in a future episode, because the next rental car I rented after this one was also a subcompact SUV, but it was only about $26,000, and I enjoyed that $26,000 subcompact SUV much more so than this Compass. But you'll have to catch the next episode to hear me talk about that next rental car. So yeah, I think overall the Compass was fine. I liked that it had a lot of features, so it was a good rental car, but I don't think I would spend my own money on a Compass. And that's going to wrap it up for us on this episode of Company Cars. Hopefully you enjoyed this discussion of affordable cars and the dearth of affordable cars in the car market, and also the long-awaited return of rental car roulette. And so if you have any listener questions, feel free to send them along. We're companycarspodcast@gmail.com, and make sure to follow us on Instagram as well, where we're Company Cars Podcast.